It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the DNR says nearly 2,000 bodies of water in Wisconsin have significant levels of pollution. We'll find out how they compile their list of impaired waters and what they do to clean them up. First, the company that brought Mickey Mouse to life, the Walt Disney Company, has struck a $52.4 billion deal with Fox. Disney will buy most of the assets of the conglomerate that controls major franchises like the X-Men and the Simpsons, and lots more. It's a major media acquisition. It could have a huge impact on today's entertainment industry. Eric Gordon is a clinical assistant professor at University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He's here to bring us up to date. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
This is, there are media acquisitions all the time. It seems like this is a really big one, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, in media language, this one's a blockbuster. You know, if you, just on the movie side, if you put together what Fox has in its movie operation and Disney has, that accounts for about 40% of all the movie tickets sold last year. So this is a monster company.
And with Monster Archives, right, their back catalogs of movies have a lot of the biggest movies ever made.
Well, you know, everything, you know, on the Fox side, you have The Sound of Music, Planet of the Apes, Home Alone, just, you know, almost an endless amount. And, of course, Disney, which is not just Disney. It's Disney. Disney also owns Lucasfilms. It owns Pixar. You know, it's Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. When you add this up, they have a huge back catalog. And a lot of these perennial movies, these movies that every generation of kids watch, well, it's like my kid, you know, watch them like 10 times.
Let's talk about what Disney doesn't get in this deal. They don't get the Fox broadcast channel, Fox News, and the main Fox sports channels. Is that right?
Well, yeah. They're not getting, they're sort of not getting the news end of it. They are getting the local Fox sports channels, which are actually, you know, quite lucrative. But the Fox company that will be left is going to be very focused on the Fox News Channel, the Fox Business Channel. They also own, you know, the Fox Network, and they also own television stations around the country. So going to be very broadcast-oriented.
Are consumers going to see a difference in what's produced and how it's distributed to them?
Well, Disney CEO Bob Iger this morning during the announcement did what CEOs always do when they announce a big acquisition. They lay out the why this will help consumers idea. It will be more efficient. It will give them more choice. It's not clear how it gives them more choice. It's pretty clear that it gives Disney more control. I'm not sure how that gives me more choice. And in fact, I suspect the reason Disney did this acquisition is to give me more choice to look at Disney products.
And yeah, we're in a changed media landscape and changing media landscape where more and more we're not turning on a channel at a particular time or even necessarily going to a movie theater at a particular time. We're streaming on a small device, a big device, you name it. Is that part of the motivation here for Disney?
Yeah, Rob, I think that is the motivation. So there's this streaming, or sometimes called over-the-top, that people are moving to, especially the younger people that advertisers really covet. So Disney fell behind in that. And you know, at first it didn't look like, who knew if it was going to catch on, but it really has caught on. I think this is a catch-up move by Disney so that it doesn't lose the power it's had on cable, the power it's had in movie theaters, doesn't lose that power in the new distribution channels. So I think that's the biggest driver. Disney did not need to get bigger. It wasn't, well, Disney's too small, doesn't have sufficient scale. I think it's a defensive move to keep market share in the new distribution channel you described.
And Disney, as I understand it, and maybe I've got this wrong, Disney owns part of the streaming service Hulu. Fox owned another part of Hulu, so now Disney has more of it. Is that maybe going to be an important part of Disney's distribution now?
Yeah, well, so it now has a majority interest. It would be interesting to see what it does with that, because Disney has announced that it's going to do two streaming services. It announced it before this deal. And they're going to have a streaming service next year for the ESPN products, and they're going to launch their own streaming service, which would have competed with Hulu, in 2019 for their film products. Now that they control Hulu, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens with Hulu. You know, there's still two other players in Hulu. There's NBC Universal, and there's Time Warner.
We're talking to Eric Gordon from the University of Michigan, looking at this big media deal between Disney and Fox. Disney getting most of what Fox does, except for a lot of the key cable TV properties. Eric, I've been talking about this as a done deal in some ways. This still has to pass muster for antitrust regulators, right?
Yeah, and I don't think that's a slam dunk. I mean, first of all, Disney would be by far the largest entertainment company in the country, and there are all kinds of antitrust questions. You know, combining all of Fox's movies and Disney's movies, that's a problem. Big problem adding Fox's regional sports channels to Disney's ESPN, you know, 10 or 20 page menu of channels. And then there's the so-called vertical antitrust questions. If Disney controls lots more of the content that it can distribute through its own channel, will that block other distributors? Or if it owns more distribution channels, can it block more content producers? So I think the antitrusters are going to give a pretty good look at that. You know, we got a hint in the AT&T Time Warner deal that antitrusters are not just going to say, oh, okay, well, we don't see any problem here because you're a vertical merger. I think the magnifying glass is going to be out, and there's going to be a lot of scrutiny.
So if Disney makes a movie like, say, I don't know, a new Star Wars movie, they own that. They could, if they wanted, say, hey, if you ever want to stream this, you have to come to our shop. You have to do Hulu or one of the other distribution channels they'll have. We're going to block the Amazons and Netflixes and whoever else out of the market. Could that be looked at as anti-competitive behavior?
Oh, that would be. And in fact, we've seen this before with movie companies back before I think both of us were born. The movie studios owned the theaters. That's why in many towns there's a Fox Theater or a Paramount Theater. So the people who produced the movies owned the distribution outlet, which at the time was the movie theaters. The government, in a really famous antitrust case, broke that up. So this is, in a sense, you know, possibly revisiting that. Disney has the movies, and they can distribute it through their streaming service, and Netflix and other streaming services don't get it. Could be enough similarity to cause the antitrusters to block the deal.
We've talked some about Disney's motivations. What is in it for Fox? I guess 50-some billion dollars in Disney stock is not bad, but is that better for them than keeping this sort of sprawling broadcast and content empire?
You know, yeah, it's a very good price. It's a very good price at a very good time for Fox. Fox is basically controlled by Rupert Murdoch. I think, you know, there are probably family issues going on there. And, you know, his heart is really in the news business. So in addition to Fox News, he owns through or controls through another company newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post and a couple of papers in England. So, it may be just that less hassle, easier for him to focus on where he started. He started as a newspaper guy and, you know, going back to that. It still does have all of those television stations, though.
I want to talk about the future of how we watch stuff now. For a while, of course, we had a few broadcast channels, then there were a couple more, then cable came along and shook that up. Now we're seeing people cut the cords away from cable, but it seems like the streaming options are stacking up. It used to be you might add HBO to your cable. Oh, now there's Netflix. Oh, but now there's Amazon and Hulu, and CBS has their Star Trek thing. You can only get it through their streaming. Are we going to end up with this whole smorgasbord of streaming services?
You know, we might. It might be like, you know, cable, 242 channels. I think it'll boil down to a smaller number. But this is the history of entertainment. You know, entertainment used to be live. You had to go to a theater. Then you could go to the movies. Then you could watch television, or then, I guess, next radio, then television. Entertainment has always had these business model, these market shifts driven by new technology. Who knows what will happen when there's virtual reality that isn't those big, crazy-looking welder's glasses. The constant in entertainment is that the new technology gives us more choice and more freedom. With streaming, we watch it when we want to watch it. We watch what we want to watch. If you don't want to watch a 3.5-hour, fairly boring NFL game, you just want to watch a few highlights, there'll be streaming channels that just give you the good stuff.
Are there going to be defensive mergers now, people looking at Disney and Fox and saying, uh-oh, we better get bigger ourselves?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing about mergers. Whatever industry you watch, whether it's this or the drugstores, pharmaceutical companies, mergers beget mergers because everybody is competing. Everybody's negotiating with other people, and if somebody gets more power by getting bigger, the other people got to get bigger to have equal power. So, at some point you end up with just two or three, unless the government takes a strong stand.
Should the government take a stronger stand, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think the government needs to take a more sophisticated look at antitrust and determine what the real terms of competition are. It's not just these horizontal movies where mergers where, oh, you make movies and I make movies. Looking carefully at these vertical mergers where you say, well, you'll control more distribution, so that doesn't necessarily just hit other distributors. It could also hit content providers. I think a more sophisticated look at what could really restrict our choices or raise our prices is exactly what the antitrusters need to do, and there's some sign that that is what they're doing.
We'll leave it there for now, Eric. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's Eric Gordon. He's a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He joined us to take a look at this big $52.4 billion deal between Disney and 21st Century Fox, a lot of Fox assets now going over to Disney control, and what that means for the industry and for media consumers. Right now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources maintains a list of what it calls impaired waters in the state. While it doesn't account for every lake and river, the list is one of the best measurements we have of pollution in the state's waterways. In 2017, 240 areas of water were added to that list due in large part to phosphorus runoff. But even when the DNR can point to a pollutant and its source, the ability to clean things up is limited by political and environmental challenges. Scott Gordon is the associate editor for wiscontext.org. He recently wrote an article on the impaired waters list. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about this impaired waters list. How does the DNR put this together?
Under the Clean Water Act, all the states have to put together an impaired waters list. And essentially, people around the state, monitor the conditions in various bodies of water. For the purposes of this list, the state manages to do testing on about 25% of the surface waters in the state. And basically, ones that don't meet certain environmental standards are added to this list. And generally, the state submits that to the EPA and has to come up with, some kind of plan for addressing those waters.
And what kinds of impairments are we talking about? What kind of things are they testing for that would make a body of water count as impaired?
Well, there's a whole range of contaminants that are regulated under the Clean Water Act. The big one is phosphorus, but there's also all kinds of other things, problems with fish habitat, mercury, other forms of metals and kind of various things.
And phosphorus, as you said, it's way at the top of this list, right? This is the one, if there's going to be a problem, it's probably going to be phosphorus.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest single category of impaired waters are impaired for having too much phosphorus.
And what's the problem? Why is that bad if a body of water has phosphorus in it?
Well, phosphorus in and of itself isn't a bad thing. It's something that all living things use. It's a pretty basic element of life. And the problem is when you have too much of it in a body of water, it really feeds algae and other microorganisms that can really throw that ecosystem out of whack. You know, as people see in bodies of water across the state, especially during the summer when you have these, you know, nasty green slicks of algae or cyanobacteria, that's because generally there's too much of a given nutrient in the water, and that's usually phosphorus.
Yeah, we talked recently to an expert on the cyanobacteria you just mentioned, and this ultimately, and it's bad ecologically speaking, it's also a health hazard for humans and pets.
Yes, some of these microorganisms can, you know, expel toxins that harm, that can harm people or can harm animals. And they also suck a lot of the oxygen out of the body of water that they're in. And that, of course, is really bad for fish and other organisms living there.
And and where is this phosphorus coming from?
A lot of it is coming from farms in the form of fertilizer that is applied to the land and then runs off into bodies of surface water when it rains. You know, sewage is also a major source of phosphorus, but a big one is from farms, and especially manure fertilizer is really prone to running off.
And so DNR tests, say, a lake. There's too much phosphorus in it. They let the EPA know, and then what? Does anything happen after that?
Well, they have limited authority to do a whole lot about it. They can tell, a municipal sewage plant nearby, hey, you have to rein it in. They can try to work with farmers, but the state doesn't have a ton of direct authority to go in and tell, you know, all the farmers in a given area around an impaired body of water, look, you have to, you know, come up with a plan to manage how much phosphorus you're using. So, and that has to do with the way that environmental regulations are structured and distinguished between different kinds of pollution sources.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about a new piece he wrote on impaired waters in Wisconsin, how the DNR tests those, what they're looking for, what, if anything, is done when a body of water is impaired. We focused on phosphorus so far, Scott. How common, looking at some of the other pollutants they're measuring there, how commonly do they turn up in waters when the DNR goes out and tests them?
Well, again, phosphorus would be the big one, kind of the plurality of things. But, you know, there's also a fair amount of problems with too much sediment being in the water, mercury, PCBs, E. coli, fecal contamination. There's quite a lot of different things that are tested. But like the top ones are phosphorus, sediment, mercury. There's a bunch of things on the list that are actually listed as unknown pollutants where someone can clearly tell there's a problem in the ecosystem, but they're not exactly sure what's causing it or haven't necessarily detected the kind of regulatory cutoff of a certain kind of chemical. So there's a whole kind of plurality of things that get into these bodies of water.
And you mentioned that regulatory cutoff. Who sets that level? There can be X amount of phosphorus. There can be X amount of mercury, I guess. Who decides what is the peak level there?
Generally speaking, the EPA, and of course the state has an ability to, you know, create its own regulations, but a lot of what it's doing is, you know, enforcing the federal regulations.
So is the DNR able to keep up with all the testing it has to do or wants to do after some recent changes in DNR staffing in the last few years?
That's been a really open question, as, you know, the DNR has seen all these budget cuts and staff cuts and all these kind of, political attempts to curb its regulatory authority. What the DNR told me was that for this list, it was able to test about 25% of the surface waters in the state. And I mean, when you consider the tremendous amount of lakes and rivers and streams, and, you know, it's a lot to cover. And so covering every single thing would kind of be impossible. And any kind of scientific study is, you know, you're dealing with a sample size that's not necessarily the entirety of something. You know, one thing the DNR has said about this list and its growth is that the list is growing not necessarily because pollution is getting worse, but because they're gradually managing to test more bodies of water, and they have had some standards that have changed over the years since they began creating this list. You know, this list, they've been updating it since about the late 80s, I want to say. And of course, over that time, you know, environmental standards have changed. Phosphorus standards especially have gotten a little stricter. So it's hard to necessarily look at it and say, oh, these problems are getting worse because the list is growing.
Now, the impaired waters list might be the best measure we have on pollution in Wisconsin waters, but it's, as you say, it's not complete, not perfect, I would guess. What do you think we should take away from this list and the growth of polluted waters that we saw in the last couple of years?
Well, I think one of the biggest lessons, if you look at this list, is that there's a lot of bodies of water that have been on there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's a reminder that despite people's best efforts, it can take a long time for these things to get sorted out. You know, if there's too much mercury in an ecosystem or too much phosphorus, and someone does something about it, it can still take, you know, decades for that chemical to kind of cycle out of the ecosystem or get down to acceptable levels. And, you know, to the DNR's point about this doesn't necessarily reflect pollution getting worse, you know, that may or may not be true, but I think it's telling when you look at this list and a problem like phosphorus is spread out across, you know, nearly every single county in the state. I think it really kind of gives you a sense of what we have to deal with on a statewide level.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. He joined us to talk about what goes into creating the DNR's list of impaired waterways in Wisconsin. You can follow that and other reporting on the state over at wiscontext.org. It's a busy time of year for Wisconsin sports teams. The Packers are eyeing up a playoff run with the return, apparently, of quarterback Aaron Rodgers. The Badger football team is headed to the Orange Bowl, but not the national championship. And the Milwaukee Bucks are showing a lot of promise with a lot of young talent on the team. Sports fans, we love them, and we'd love to hear from you. Which Wisconsin team are you following now? What are your hopes for Aaron Rodgers and the Packers? Should Rodgers be coming back after his injury? Do you feel uniquely connected to your Wisconsin team? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're following a bunch of stories. Of course, the big one, the Green Bay Packers. I'd be interested to hear from you about the Aaron Rodgers story. They have an outside chance to make the playoffs. Aaron Rodgers returning from that collarbone injury. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom Oates joins us now for a winter sports roundup. He's a sports columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, I want to start with the Packers. Promising start to the season. Less promising after Aaron Rodgers broke his collarbone back in October. Earlier this week, he was cleared to play. Want to listen to a clip from an interview with Rodgers. This is yesterday.
Obviously, I think there's an expectation of the way I play. That's what it means to be a leader in this locker room and the quarterback of this team is going out and performing and doing your job. Hopefully, it gives a lift to some of the guys. But, you know, I'm not coming back to save this team. I'm coming back to play quarterback the way I know how to play it. And hopefully we all raise the level of our play collectively and find a way to win these three games.
So this is some big sports drama, Tom. Before we get into Rodgers himself, what has to happen for the Packers to make it into the playoffs this year?
Oh, all kinds of things have to happen. they don't, as they say in sports, control their own destiny. They would need a little help. But the one thing they have to do is they have to win these last three games. It's probably I think there's nine teams still contending for the playoffs in the NFC. It's the toughest schedule of the nine. They play three of those nine teams here to close out. So they have to win those, and then they'll need a little help with either Atlanta or Carolina losing should they win out.
And
Seattle. Those three teams would be the ones they would be. And at probably at best what they can do is slip into the wild card, maybe the sixth wild card spot in the NFC.
Let's look at winning those games. Now, even with Aaron Rodgers at 100% healthy, that's not a lock. That's not a gimme to win any one of those three games, right?
No. Carolina and Minnesota are the first two. It's at Carolina, which is a real test given that Rodgers – you know, you can expect a little rust after 8 weeks and going through what he's gone through medically. Carolina is a 9-4 team, very good team. But the thing is that they have a top five defense in the league. Minnesota's next. They have a top five defense in the league. Nothing easy about these games at all, with or without Rodgers. What I've always said, though, is that Rodgers is the equalizer. He allows this team to compete with any team in the NFL, and I think that'll be the case.
And you wrote about the decision for Aaron Rodgers to come back after that broken collarbone. I think probably Wisconsin has become the most expert state in collarbones in the union over the last few weeks. But you wrote about this, talk about the decision to come back as opposed to taking another few weeks to heal.
Well, I think it's lost in the shuffle. He broke his left collarbone in 2013, mm-hmm. and his bone wasn't like 100% absolutely locked, healed. And I think that's the case again this time. But he came back. They beat the Bears. They made the playoff in the last game. They made the playoffs. I don't know. It certainly appears from all the machinations that went on Monday and Tuesday that the bone isn't 100% healed, but he's got plates in there, and he clearly felt it was he's healthy enough to come back, and I think he convinced the doctors he was healthy enough to come back. I have great faith in the Packers team doctor, Pat McKenzie. I think he's a very honorable man. I think he errs on the side of caution with players. He's held players out when they didn't want to be held out. And really, I don't think Aaron Rodgers, I think there are physicians and team physicians that would have put Aaron Rodgers out on that field much easier than Pat McKenzie did. And if Rodgers is out there, that means that Dr. McKenzie is okay with it. And based on what I know of Pat McKenzie, I'm fine with that as well, because I think, like I said, he's a guy who errs on the side of the caution. Sometimes the coaches get mad at him because they can't get their hands back on players because Doc McKenzie says no. And so that's why I think this isn't that great of a risk.
We're talking to sports writer Tom Oates from the Wisconsin State Journal. It's a Wisconsin sports roundup focusing a lot on the Green Bay Packers and the return of Aaron Rodgers. What was your reaction? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What went through your mind when Aaron Rodgers went down and you heard about this major injury? Do you think he's right to be coming back onto the field this weekend? What do you think of the Packers' hopes? What's your connection with the Packers? Do you feel that sort of relationship that maybe people, fans of other teams, don't? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom, let's talk about the Packers' run in the last bunch of years. They've made the playoffs a lot, more than their fair share if it was all averaged out.
Yeah, it's been 8 years since 2009. I think that's tied for the longest streak ever in the NFL. It's been a great run. You don't have great runs like that in the NFL anymore unless you have a great quarterback. That's just pure the way the league has trended, is that it's a passing league, and if you don't have a really good one, you're not going to be that consistently good team year in and year out. So I think even there have been years in there, 09, 10, 11, where the Packers had great talent, and there's been years where they haven't had great talent, but yet Rodgers has been able to lift them into the playoffs. So 8 years in a row is a tremendous run. I think the Patriots are also on a similar 8-year run, and guess who their quarterback is? Tom Brady. So there's a real cause and effect there. These great quarterbacks give you a chance to win and be a consistent winner year in and year out. Now, the Badgers weathered Rodgers' collarbone injury in 2013. They've seemingly weathered his injury here because their goal was to get to this game where he could come back and still have a chance to make the playoffs, and they still have a chance to make the playoffs. So they didn't look great at any point during that stretch, but they got to where they needed to get, and now he's back, and they have a chance to keep what I think is a tremendous streak alive.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hi. I've been watching the Packers since the 1960s and supported them ever since. I'm debating that now because of the emissions and global warming from all those airplanes and people flying all over the place.
Okay, Michael, thanks. He has environmental concerns about the team, but he's been watching since the 60s, he said. Let's go now to Tom in Muscadet. Tom, hi.
Hi. Just a few things. I wish he wouldn't play. I would rather he wait till next season. I would hope that Ted Thompson would be gone by then. We'd get some offensive linemen, maybe a good pass rusher free trade in the trade. Just things like that. The D-backs aren't up to par, so that's just my humble opinion.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. So Tom, a Packers fan, Tom Oates, who says he wishes Rodgers wouldn't play. And I got to say, I and a lot of people are going to be out there anytime anybody lays a finger on Aaron Rodgers, we're going to freak out, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of fingers crossed in Wisconsin all day Sunday, I think, as they watch that game, because he, you know, you're going to cringe every time he gets hit and you know, hope he gets up and can still continue on and play. But that's the decision they've made. As far as some of Tom's points, I thought a couple of points he made were really good, and that is their biggest needs, to my way of thinking, are pass rusher and defensive back, especially cornerbacks on the outside. And I agree with Tom 100%. Those areas of the team are really lacking right now, somewhat due to injury, somewhat due to youth, somewhat due to poor decisions in drafting and player acquisition. So those are definitely areas of that need improvement. As far as Ted Thompson, I think the only way Ted Thompson goes is if Ted Thompson decides he wants to retire. I'd be surprised if the current Packer regime would dump Ted Thompson. I just don't see that happening. Packer fans are certainly angry in some cases and mostly frustrated, I think, at some of the things Thompson does and doesn't do. But again, those 8 straight playoff appearances signify something. And it's been a consistent franchise. You know, you kind of wish sometimes, and I've written this a number of times, that Thompson would just go outside the box a little bit and augment his roster with a free agent or two or a trade or something a little out of the ordinary for the way they operate with this draft and develop philosophy. But I don't think Packers administration is nearly as down on Ted Thompson as some fans are. And I know that frustrates people, but that's the reality of it.
We're talking about Wisconsin sports with Tom Oates, sports columnist at the Wisconsin State Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you watching in the Wisconsin sports world? Are you excited for the return of Aaron Rodgers or worried? Do you think the Packers will still make the playoffs this year? How about the Badger football team? Were they given a fair shake in the college football rankings? Was it a good run while it lasted? What do you think about the Orange Bowl? Is there a sports team in Wisconsin we haven't talked about? There's a lot of good teams, UW-Green Bay women's basketball, Marquette basketball, UW men's basketball, maybe not so great this year. Call 800-642-1234, but we still love them, Dean. I saw you shake your head there. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We pick up our conversation now with Tom Oates, sports columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal. We're talking about the Packers and other Wisconsin sports, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do the Packers have a shot at the playoffs? Is it the right decision to bring back Aaron Rodgers after his collarbone injury? Are you going to be watching the Badgers in the Orange Bowl? Are you watching the Bucks this year? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to our callers. Ed is with us in Madison. Ed, hi.
Hi. I go back to Tobin Road days, if anybody remembers him. That's when the Packers were called the Cinderella team, and they weren't much good. But anyway, I have a concern that goes beyond winning games. I don't know if it's – I think it's occurred at least to some fans and maybe sports writers that players are getting bigger and faster, and the injuries, whether it be brain or other things, including collarbones, is getting to be epidemic. I'm particularly concerned about high school players. They're not developed yet. Even their skulls aren't fully developed, and they're getting their brains knocked out, you know? And I just think there needs to be some reasoning going on here in terms of either changing some rules or doing something to reduce the severity of injuries and making it more of a game less brutal.
Ed, thanks for the call. And there was that very scary injury in a Steelers-Bengals game earlier this year and a couple near misses there. Tom, is this something that's changing the way people watch and think about football, and maybe we'll change the rules in the near future?
Well, I think it's changing the way parents think about football. I can tell you that. I think participation is down. There's a lot of concern about this already. The NFL has made rules, and I think the one of the injuries you just referenced was Ryan Shazier of Pittsburgh Steelers, who still maybe has some spinal issues, and I doubt that I'm an armchair quarterback in here, but it doesn't sound like he'll ever play again. There's a lot of rules, but you can't legislate the hitting out of football. It's a violent physical sport. We like some of that. I don't think we glorify or like the big monster hits anymore. I think we've kind of changed the mindset on that. When you see something and then you see a player laying on the ground, maybe twitching with a concussion, I think it repulses people now. And, you know, I think 40, 50 years ago, they might have put that on TV in a bloopers type highlight reel. Here's the NFL with this monster hit. So they've changed some way of thinking. It's hard. What's happened, I think, in my mind, what's clearly happened is players used to be, the Tobin Roth days or even the glory years Packers days, the tackles were 250 pounds. Now there's 330. And, it stands to reason there's more mass. They're better developed. I mean, weight training, maybe drug, a little help from, certain performance-enhancing drugs, all those kinds of things. The bodies are just bigger and faster, and, you can develop your muscles and all you want, but your ligaments and tendons and all that are used to, designed in your body to bear a certain stress, I think. And when you get that kind of speed and size, I think you're really pushing the limits. And that's why we see all these injuries. I think the NFL is in a panic mode right now because look who's out. Quarterbacks, J.J. Watt. Some of their greatest players aren't playing this year. Aaron Rodgers missed 8 games. And that's bad for business. And what's bad for business usually spurs the NFL, and the NFL usually drives this. Now, I know the caller talked a little bit about high schools. I think the speed of the high school game, you don't have that as many injuries as you see in the NFL or even in major college football. You still have injuries. You've always had injuries. But, these kids aren't as big and overdeveloped. I do think high school kids are better developed now than they were in the past, but you don't see, the lines that are 320 pounds across and that kind of thing.
Thanks for the call, Ed. We're talking to Tom Oates, sports columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal. Back to your calls. Gordon is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Gordon, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What do you think, Gordon?
Well, I think that it's going to be a great day when Aaron Rodgers takes the field on Sunday. It's going to be a tough game. The Carolina's really tough, but I think that he can make it be the difference maker and knock off the Panthers. I can't wait for the Badgers to knock the snot out of Miami. Miami's got this big talk. They just want to see the big old Wisconsin boys go down there and just put a licking on them.
Gordon, thanks for the call. And let's transition over to Badgers football now. We spent more time than I planned on Packers, Tom. Badgers, great run in the regular season this year. Got knocked off, looked a little flat against Ohio State in the Big Ten Championship. But they're still in a big bowl.
Yeah, I don't know if they look flat. I think Ohio State's good. I don't think Wisconsin had seen that kind of speed in quite a while, and not since last year. And I think it took Wisconsin a little bit of time to adjust to that speed, that all-over-the-field speed that Ohio State has, that really not even Michigan among their opponents had that kind of speed, especially on offense where
you know, every skill player on Ohio State is a potential game breaker. And that really hurt Wisconsin in the first half. They ended up coming back and having a shot to win, but it was a horribly disappointing loss. You know, Wisconsin hasn't really been able to quite get over that hump and compete for a national championship. And you know, that last week when the committee put them in fourth, it was an invitation. Beat Ohio State and you're in. And they were unable to beat Ohio State, so it was horribly disappointing. But I think if you look at the way this team operates, they'll come back, and I think they'll be really ready to play Miami. It probably helps that it's a big name like Miami. I don't think Miami was the U for all those years, and this team contending for national championships with 22 future NFL players in its lineup, and you know, that was 15, 20 years ago. That Miami hasn't been at that level. It might get there under Mark Richt, who's in his second year as coach, but they're not at that level yet. And I think it's going to be a really good matchup. And if Wisconsin comes to play, I think they should win the game.
I want to take a quick look at the Milwaukee Bucks. It wasn't that many years ago that they were pretty bad. It was a rough team to watch sometimes. I haven't watched as closely, but it seems like they're a lot more fun to watch these days.
Yeah, they have better players. Amazing how that
works. That'll really make a difference. I'm no sports expert.
No, I think they're in about phase three of a rebuilding plan. The first phase is acquiring some decent young talent, and the second phase is developing it. And now you see players like Giannis and Jabari Parker and Chris Middleton, and they traded for Eric Bledsoe. These are good players. These are high-quality NBA players. Giannis is a star. Jabari Parker obviously still out with a knee injury, but he's due back after the first of the year at some point. They're in a phase now where they're trying to put players around their stars to become an elite-level team. I think their record is, I'm not sure right now, 15-11, maybe something like that. They've become a good team. They've become a dangerous team. But the really elite-level teams are a threat to win every single night and win when they don't play well and those kinds of things. And I don't think they're there yet, and they're still struggling a little bit. They're clearly not very good in the middle, or very strong, I should say, in the middle. They have a lot of pretty good perimeter players, and they've added some shooting and this and that. Their defense isn't very good at times. So they have a ways to go, but they've become an entertaining team and in some ways a contending team. I think they have the fourth best record in the East.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today. Enjoy the game, the Packers game this weekend.
All right, my pleasure, Rob.
That's Tom Oates, sports columnist at the Wisconsin State Journal. We've been talking about Wisconsin sports, catching up on all the latest news, including the return of Aaron Rodgers after a major injury. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this, by the way. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And as always, you can go over and post or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Some food news from our neighbors to the west. A Twin Cities restaurant says it's making now Minnesota-style pizza. They've been doing it for over 50 years, they say, but they're actually defining what Minnesota-style pizza is. As reported in the Pioneer Press, here's the definition from the restaurant Red's Savoy. It's thin crust, square cut, loads of toppings, cheese, and a spicy, passive-aggressive sauce. Does Minnesota get to have its own pizza style? Producer Halima Shah is from the land of Chicago deep dish. Hey, Halima.
Hey, Rob.
Well, first of all, you're from the Chicago area. Do you like the deep dish, the Chicago style?
Okay, so
you're gonna admit something.
Yeah, I am, and I shouldn't, but no, I'm not a fan. But it's iconic,
right?
And the Minnesota pizza is not.
Yeah, so New York has its pizza, Chicago, maybe San Francisco. Not every place gets to have its own pizza style.
I don't think so. I think it's about branding. Chicago's is deep dish, and you need a knife and fork and an hour to eat it. And then, you know, New York's is super thin, and Minnesota's, there's nothing too unique about it.
I did some research. I looked around for what a Wisconsin-style pizza is. Some places, you know, restaurants will say, we're Wisconsin-style pizza, but I don't think it's a thing, right?
It's not a thing. You know, not every state needs to have its pizza. Pick dairy or cookies or
we've got
milk
our cheese.
Or
yeah.
Cheese or something else.
Like, Minnesota can have its Minnesota-style tater tot casserole.
There you go.
Hot dish.
Yeah.
That's yours. No soda pizza. Sorry. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.